Good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another great show, hopefully, for you. We really appreciate everybody checking out the show over at disasterpodcast.com and checking out the episodes, and we really work hard to bring a variety of different topics to you, and I think you're going to find that to be true again this week. Before we get into all of that, though, I do want to, as always, welcome my co-host and cohort in crime here, Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
I'm great, Jamie. It's quite warm out here. We're kind of having another little mini heat wave, but we shall prevail. And this is going to be an awesome podcast today. But before we go any further, we have our best friend, Dr. Joe Holly, with us, who's always got something wonderful to say. Say hi, Joe.
Hi, Joe. How are you guys tonight?
I knew when I said that. I shouldn't have said that. Good to have you back, as always. And I think with you here, this will be quite a spirited conversation. And actually, I went to lunch with a good friend of mine that has kind of travels all over the place, and I hadn't actually seen him for a few years. And as I'm sitting there, I'm going, wow, he would make a really good podcast because he's another federal employee that does something quite different than what Joe and I do. So that's what we're going to talk about. So I'm going to throw it right at you, Troy, and tell him a little bit about what you do.
Well, my name is Troy Mead. I've been an emergency services worker about 22 years. I started as an EMT and then became a paramedic and went on to become a certified emergency manager. I started in the state of Kansas. The first actual major disaster that I ever went to, I was not affiliated with DMAT or DMORT at that time. It was kind of a local Kansas search and rescue team, and we went to the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19th, 1995. And that was kind of my first experience and my first disaster, and it's kind of growing from there. I went on to college in Florida to obtain my degree in emergency management, and while I was in Florida, we had Hurricanes Ivan, Francis, Jean, and Charlie that year in 2004, and I was hired by FEMA as a reservist, and that's how I kind of got involved. And my specific job title then, I was a bereavement case worker. So I handled all the bereavement cases of any of the deaths that were related to any of the hurricanes. And it was about a 5-month process. After I completed that, I was invited to join DMAT 9 on the West Coast. And here I am, and that's kind of how I met Sam.
Well, you'd mentioned bereavement, and hold that thought, because that actually is one thing that I had a question about that I don't honestly know the answer to is, you know, how was that factored into the process? But I'm going to throw a little story at you first to kind of lead into this, because Joe and I have talked a lot about our different roles, myself as a DMAT, Disaster Medical Assistance Team, and Joe as a USAR doc. But, you know, envision a scenario where Joe's out there digging people out of the rubble after an earthquake and passes them off to me on the DMAT to take care of. Well, obviously not everyone survives in those situations. And we're going to talk a little bit about what happens next and who are the people that actually make that happen. And we call that the DMORT, or the Disaster Medical
Mortuary Assistance Team.
Right.
Mortuary Assistance Team.
I just like totally blank on that. Yes, but that's what we're going to talk about, because Troy knows much about that too. But I remember when, yeah, thank you, Joe. Mortuary team, disaster, medical disaster. I am so messing this up. Okay, yes, but the mortuary team. So these are the folks that go out, you know, in a disaster and actually handle the dead, with a lot of respect, I might add. And on that note, I remember very clearly at Ground Zero that one of the things that really sticks in my mind is several times a day, and it so happened we were 6 weeks in after the event, and several times a day there would be three horns blowing, virtually everybody stopped what they were doing, all the heavy equipment, everything just stopped, because that meant that they found a body. And the ritual they went through even gives me chills as I'm speaking of it. They would back up an FDNY ambulance. The guys that found what they found would drape it with a flag. They would ceremoniously, and everybody's, you know, dirty from working, it isn't about that, but they would put them in the ambulance, and then the ambulance would drive away. And I saw this again and again, and I appreciated what was going on. But I asked my commander one day, I said, so what happens next? Where do they go? What do they do? And one particular afternoon, we used to drive around in these little 4x4s, little tiny gators, and he says, jump on. And I don't question him, and so I jumped on, and he took me over to where the demort was actually working. And what I do know is they do take sampling of whatever they have so they can try and identify people later. But then when that process was finished and the remains came back out, they were again draped with a flag and put back in the ambulance, and the firefighters were three on either side, walk alongside until that ambulance has left the ground. So even in the midst of all this, there was a huge amount of respect, regardless of who the remains belonged to. It didn't matter if it was a firefighter or somebody that from the towers, but the level of respect that was shown still now gives me chills. So I'm going to throw it back to you, Troy, and obviously you have a number of roles we could discuss and what it is you do, but on the demort side, tell us what a demort is and what they actually do.
I can tell you I was not at 9/11. I am familiar with the process that you mentioned, and that is exactly what occurred when they found. We don't use the word human body. Typically, we use the word human remains as a more of a respect for the person, because it's a person. It's not just a body. It's a human. So we use the word human remains. So if you hear me say the word human remains, that's why I term it like that. Typically, I know they would go after they would remove them from the wherever they found them at. They went to one of the demort stations, and at the demort stations, we have different sections that the remains would go through. And it's a temporary morgue facility, just like any city would have, but it's a portable unit. And we have three of those units throughout the U.S.: one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, and one in the Midwest. And the main purpose is victim identification. The stations they go through is forensic dental pathology, you know, dental x-rays. If we can get dental records, you know, we try to do that also. We have a dental station that does x-rays. We have a forensic anthropology with anthropologists who are on our team for bone identifications and so forth. And then the remains continue to go through processing through the DNA process. And then they are prepared for shipment out to the temporary storage facility or the funeral home of choice of the family. You know, our goal at demort is to quickly process the human remains and get them back to their loved ones as soon as possible so they can put closure to it. In Florida, when I did the bereavement cases in Florida, it was a little bit different there because it was pretty widespread, and not every claim that we had was a disaster-related death. But typically when there is a disaster-related death, you can file with FEMA for bereavement assistance to help pay for funeral costs. At that time, it was $7,000 that the federal government would give you assistance if the death was related to a disaster, which is typically the time frame that whatever they set before and after the disaster. But our main goal at DMAT, like I said, is to get the human remains processed and get the loved ones back home to their family so they can have a proper burial and put proper closure to the event.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's ironic that we're doing this now, because kind of the big story right now is the remains actually coming back, the ones they were not able to identify coming back to Ground Zero. There's some discussion about the appropriateness of where we're going, but we're not going to touch on that. The point I'm trying to make is, they're hoping at some point in time, just like back in the 70s and 80s before they had DNA and they were able to keep information that then could be decoded through DNA, they're hoping that there will be some technology down the road in 10 or 20 years that these people still may be able to be identified. And I guess that's the hope. I'd love to hear your take on this, Joe.
Well, we certainly had similar experiences at the Pentagon. I think issues around 9/11 were all the more complicated due to the sort of legal crime scene aspect of all of that. So as we would discover bodies in the Pentagon, we would identify the remains and then let pass the word outside that we had made a find, as it were. And what would come in was actually very interesting. It was guys from the old guard, who are the military regiment that's assigned there in Washington, D.C. to protect the Capitol. And they're a very traditional, rather elite kind of unit who all these guys are 6'4" and, you know, look very much alike and are, you know, just phenomenal looking people in general. But they would, four of those guys would come in with a stretcher, followed by a priest, basically, and they would come to wherever we had marked the spot where the remains were found, put the remains in a body bag, put it on the stretcher, and the priest would do last rites, and then they would go out a sort of a back way awaiting ambulances as well there. But initially, those remains were also evaluated. They were taken up to Quantico, I think, for identification, all that sort of stuff. But obviously, the law enforcement folks were heavily engaged in looking at each one of those to ensure that there weren't any crime-related clues or anything like that that needed to be collected as part of that. But I too was very taken by the extremely respectful way that that was handled.
Wow. And that's something we never talked about. I guess, especially with the Pentagon being so high profile. I can't even imagine. My mind's going off in 40 different directions because I have so many questions I could ask, and there's just so many things we can touch on. But you guys talked, you were both apparently at some of the same incidents in Florida after similar disasters. So we're talking about specifically Ground Zero and the Pentagon. But when you're dealing with a larger disaster, certainly like Katrina or any of the various floods that we've had, certainly the issues in Florida, how are those handled a little bit differently, Troy? Because you're dealing with a larger area and certainly more people.
In Katrina, we had a lot of problems with older cemeteries. And with the older cemeteries, the actual vaults and caskets would pop up through the ground. And a lot of those had to be broken open, and the remains had to be identified, which was a very difficult task for DMORT to do because the water table there in New Orleans is so high that it caused a major problem with a lot of cemeteries and putting everybody back where they belonged. There wasn't a whole lot of records that dated back to when these people were buried. And that was a big problem in Louisiana. And, a lot of people just kind of pretty much new funerals or new services for those loved ones if we could find who they belonged to. Otherwise, we tried to place them back to where we found them and put them in new enclosures and new encasings. So that was a big problem in the South, and it was widespread, but we had enough teams to handle it in different areas as far as the DMORT aspect of it.
You know, you're bringing a memory back to me, and I'm really going to date myself here. Oh, my God. But in 1985, I was actually doing Red Cross work then, as long before I knew what a DMAT actually was. And my first deployment was Hurricane Juan, which hit the southern part of Louisiana, way down in the bayou. And I remember that exact incident of all of those caskets floating around, and they weren't that easily identifiable. That's always been kind of a mystery to me. But let's talk this, as the premium example of what you're talking about, let's discuss Katrina a little bit. We're talking about a lot of people. How did you handle that with that number of people? You have to think at some point in time you're going to run out of places to put people. And the fact that it would take so long to actually recover those remains, what are the disease concerns that we might run into? That's going to be a whole secondary thing that a lot of people haven't given much thought to, and that's got to be huge.
There has been a widespread myth throughout the years that started around the 1900s and that dead bodies posed a risk to the public. And typically they would pose a risk to the public if they were buried in areas where they were close to fresh water supply that the public could drink. And typically back then they worried about typhoid fever, cholera, and the plague. And in the 1900s, that's also when the embalming process was developed, and that was kind of the push to embalm bodies to make them safe, if you will, to be buried in the embalming process to stop the disease process, which it can stop some disease process, but it was more of a development to preserve the body for the family to view. So typically, you know, it's not a high risk to the public. It's more of a risk to the DMORT team and the responders who are handling the remains, you know, but we use proper PPE and equipment to handle these remains. So it's a lot less risk. I would say that the higher risk that's really a threat to DMORT would be, you know, a biological agent or a chemical agent that the bodies are contaminated with. And we have two DMORT teams that are hazmat DMORT teams that deal specifically with decontaminating human remains. But, you know, if there was a significant amount of number of those, that would be a very time-consuming process. There is also a process to where we could do temporary interment to where we could place, you know, the human remains underground. And we can put about 800 human remains underground in a fiberglass casing, you know, and store them there until the epidemic would be over with, and then we could bring them back up and do a proper burial to the family, for the family.
Joe, wow. I have a question for you. When you are, as a USAR unit, you're doing search and rescue, but does that ever turn into search and recovery? And do you have to, or do you just mark the remains and then turn that over to a unit like a DMORT unit?
Well, there's been a lot of variability there, quite honestly. Yes, it often is search and recovery. Certainly, there's an awful lot of that. There was nothing but that at the Pentagon, essentially. And even at Katrina, you know, we had tens of bodies that we had to deal with as well. And as Troy so accurately talked about, there were lots and lots of concerns amongst the folks in the neighborhoods there, that if there was a dead body in a house, that they were going to come down with some horrible disease and all that sort of stuff. And just a lot of concern about how that was dealt with. For us, in general, what we would do is if we discovered a body someplace, then we would place the body in a body bag. And it varied a little bit depending sort of at what phase we were in our work there. Early on, they would tend to be, we would notify the incident support team, the leadership command and control function, and let them know that someone needed to come out. And, you know, they had a team like Troy's that would come out and pick up the body. Later, you know, but for a while there was often nobody to do that. So in many cases, we would simply have to put that body someplace where it was a bit more appropriate. In other words, we wouldn't leave it, you know, in the street or in a house or something like that. We would remove it back to a collection area, essentially, and then turn it over to proper authorities when we had an opportunity to do so.
Wow, Joe, so how much training do the USAR people get on dealing with this? Because obviously you're in situations where you may need to.
Absolutely, Sam. You know, it's probably not enough. It clearly makes people very uncomfortable. I think even a lot of the folks on the USAR team get a little bit worried. I always get a few questions about, hey, we're not gonna catch anything from this, are we? And we actually have developed a couple of pages of information that we were passing out to fellow search and rescue colleagues that described, this is how we will handle a body. This is the things you need to be concerned about. This is what you don't need to be concerned about. And this is who to contact. And, you know, just kind of an FAQ, frequently asked questions kind of deal about that, because there were clearly lots of misconceptions and preconceived, ill-founded concerns about bodies, you know, being out in the world, as it were.
Well, and there's always the fact that, certainly in the case of the Pentagon and Ground Zero, that we're dealing with a crime scene, and virtually everything and everyone involved with that is part of that crime scene. And in fact, the deceased are evidence. Would that not be true, Troy?
That is very true, and that adds a very difficult aspect to it. You know, definitely. I was going to say something else about Katrina, but I'm trying to think what it was I was going to mention. Oh, last year when we had our meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with a DMORT meeting, there is plans. I can't say what the plans are because I don't know personally, but there is new plans in effect for the recovery process and who's going to be doing the exact recovery of the remains, whether it be USAR, DMAT, DMORT, whoever, because sometimes we're so overwhelmed with so many human remains that, you know, DMORT, we can't do it all at once. So there is some new plans as far as the recovery process, and I think they're actually looking at an aspect of the National Guard possibly assisting with that as well.
I have a question for you, Troy. How many deaths need to be, I guess, what are the numbers that we're talking about with human remains before a DMORT team is brought in? Is it like other things where we wait and see if the state resources are overwhelmed before they request a DMORT team to come in? Or are you deployed as part of the rest of the response when FEMA is activated for a state of disaster?
It is a state request. There is no set number of when we can be called in to be, you know, to assist. You know, it all depends on the local jurisdiction's capabilities. For example, Las Vegas, Clark County, they can handle quite a few. They have a lot of equipment. They have a lot of portable tents. They have their own portable morgue unit in Las Vegas, and so does Kansas City, for that matter. And they could probably process, I'm just guessing here, you know, anywhere from 100 to 200 people. But there's no set number, and it kind of varies jurisdiction-wise, but we have to be requested to the same level through the state, through the federal.
Yeah, Troy, this is Joe. I can certainly see the need for the expertise of someone like you and a DMORT team. I remember several instances where the law enforcement was quite concerned that a crime may have been committed and then attempted to be covered up by, blaming the storm for something happening to somebody. And the real challenges with trying to sort all that out, as you can imagine. Can you touch on that a little bit?
I can touch on that a little bit. In the state of Florida, without specific details to a case, we had probably maybe 600 cases that were filed with FEMA for federal assistance, for federal bereavement assistance for the $7,000 for funeral cost. And my job as a bereavement investigator was I would go out and I would meet with the family and I would interview them and find out the details of what happened and what occurred. And then I would look at the medical records of the human remains that were involved and kind of determine, you know, what was going on there. One case in particular was a case that was filed for a 72-year-old man who died during Hurricane Charley, and the family blamed it on the storm. They said that he was up on the roof fixing a leak, up there. But after I reviewed the medical records, I found out the gentleman was a quadriplegic, so there was no way he was up on the roof of the house fixing the water leak. So their case was denied any money. And it's kind of the same in the criminal aspect. Katrina, there's probably a lot of things that went on in Katrina that I don't know about and I really can't comment because I don't know. But unfortunately, ideally, if somebody of that nature was going to commit a crime like that, that would be the time to do that. And it would be more difficult. But if that person came to the DMORT station and, you know, any of our pathologists, you know, noticed anything out of the ordinary, it would be reported to law enforcement immediately. Typically with disasters, you see certain types of patterns and injuries that are related to that disaster. And, you know, if you came across something definitely out of the ordinary, we would report it.
Well, absolutely. That's sort of what I meant when I was talking about your expertise is being able to pick up those very subtle patterns and those inconsistencies that make you appreciate that this is not exactly as it appears. And, sure. Those are truly challenging cases. We were involved in a few of those that where the law enforcement and investigative authorities were asking a few specific questions about what was going on with us and, you know, what do we see, where do we find them, et cetera. We, you know, we took pictures and all that sort of stuff, too. But it was certainly in some of those cases very, very questionable circumstances as to what was going on there.
Absolutely.
Troy, what about the training requirements for we've talked a little bit about that with all of our different teams that we've brought in here. What does it take for somebody that is do you have to be invited to be part of a DMORT team, or is this something that you get specific training for in addition to being an emergency responder of some sort?
I was invited to join DMORT because of my background in emergency management. My title as emergency planning analyst is my title for the team, but I also have training as a forensic medical death investigator. So our team consists of, I'm the only person on my team who holds the title emergency planning analyst because I'm an emergency planner. I do planning, you know, I do the incident report for the 24 hours of the incident and so forth. But, you know, we had pathologists, we have odontologists, we have anthropologists as well. We have medical legal investigators, and we have crisis management counselors as well. So it's pretty much, you know, we pretty much invite people to join. They do take applications from the general public, but we look for certain specialties of certain areas that we need, and then we encourage those people to apply more than others because there's just, we get an overwhelming number of applications for DMORT to people that they want to volunteer and help. But if all the expertise areas are full, then we really can't use them necessarily. And we can only have a certain amount of people on the team. So that's kind of how we do that.
That's very similar to what we do on DMAT. We can have so many EMTs, so many docs, so many
yes.
mid-levels and so forth. But I got to ask you, Troy, what attracted you? I mean, was this just something you fell into, or did you have an interest in this level of medicine?
My family, on my mom's side of the family, has been involved in the mortuary business for many, many years, and I have an extended education in mortuary science as well. So a little history that you all know is, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, the funeral homes ran the ambulance services, and I became an EMT and a paramedic, and then I was also, you know, on the mortuary side of it and intrigued by that from when I was in my younger years. And so that's kind of how I got involved with it, was because I was exposed to it at a younger age of, you know, being exposed to the Cadillac-style ambulances that were also hearses. So for me, that was my aspect of it, sir. But everybody's a little bit different. But it can be a quiet job as far as the mortuary side at times. But it's also very rewarding when I can, you know, help a family out and help them put closure to what has happened to their loved one. So, you know, it kind of works in different aspects. You know, as a paramedic, I can help save a life and do that. And then the other aspect, if I'm doing the other job, then, and you know, I can help a family member in that aspect as also. It has actually been beneficial to me as a paramedic to know both sides of it, because there's many calls that I've gone on when it's just the husband or wife left there with their loved one who's passed away, and knowing the mortuary side of it and the compassionate side of it, I've been able to sit down with that person and talk to that person until another family member showed up at the scene to be there with them and not just go off and leave them with law enforcement.
Let's talk about that aspect for a minute, because we all agree how important that is, whether we're, you know, it's everyday field work or it's a disaster. But how do you interact with the family? What resources do you give them? I mean, this can be... This is the sad part about working disaster, and I'm sure that Joe can relate to this, is you're not only dealing with people's immediate medical or trauma needs, you're dealing with the fact that they may have lost their whole family and don't even know where they are. So there's that element of it, as well as the fact that they know for a fact that they lost a loved one. I mean, how does DMORT handle that?
DMORT's crisis management team handles that, and it's a team of psychiatrists and mental health workers. I personally have not had opportunity to sit down with them while they visit with families, so I cannot tell you exactly what they tell them all the time or how the process leads. But I know there is also a lot of local resources that they refer them to, also to the Red Cross as well. But these are all people that are specifically trained in this, and they're also trained in this for us first responders as well, for, you know, PTSD as well. And but DMORT does have the team that handles that part of it, and it's not something that I have a lot of knowledge of, but they're a very unique part of the team, and they're the ones that are there for the family there at the end.
Wow, that's such an important part of it.
You know, as we're getting close to the end of this episode, you know, it strikes me, Troy, that training and education is an important part of what you do, as it seems to be for all disaster responders. And I, you know, we want to make sure we give a big thank you to Joe and the rest of the gang over at Paragon Medical Education Group, because they are the ones that sponsor this program, and their educational experiences are really designed to help people be better prepared so they don't suffer PTSD, or at least not suffer it to the level that they might have if they were unprepared. Is that a good way to put that, Joe?
I think that's a great way to put that. You know, clearly after talking to Troy tonight, we've got some additional aspects that we, you know, may need to start thinking a little bit more about as we do some of our training scenarios.
We do psychological first aid training. You know, it's all required for all NDMS personnel, but psychological first aid for us is it's pretty basic, and it doesn't go too far in depth. And but it's the need is there for more of it, and for more people to learn it, definitely, and understand it. But I know our DMORT responses have gone down quite a bit. You know, when DMORT started back in the 90s, it was up to almost 3 responses a year, and now it's a lot less, fortunately, which is a good thing. But we got a lot of new team members. We haven't been exposed to anything, and we just need a lot more training there.
Sounds like an opportunity.
Yeah, it sure does. Joe, as much as you've been around, it's hard to think that there was something new you could learn, but I certainly learned a few things I didn't know about DMORT. I assume you might have, too.
Absolutely. Always do.
Joe, why don't you tell folks where we can find you and Paragon and what you guys are up to?
Well, thanks, Jamie. We're busy with active shooter training right now, so clearly a lot of psychological aspects to that kind of training. But you can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook and ParagonMedEDU on Twitter.
Excellent. Troy, how about you? Is there a place that there are resources or an online presence for your DMORT team or this type of response?
Pretty much, we're just under the public health page under DMORT.org, and it kind of explains the DMORT team from A to Z, and that's pretty much it as far as the DMORT aspect. Unfortunately, the DMORT aspect, a lot of people don't want to know about that aspect of it. That, you know, the public doesn't, you know, but we're there for them, and you know, usually when we are there, we explain what we do, and they're happy to be there. But prior to disaster, sometimes they don't want to hear about DMORT or anything to do with mortuaries because of that fear of the fear of death. So, but DMORT.org and also on the NDMS public health page under DMORT is where you can find most of our information, and it will also show you where all of our teams are located throughout the U.S.
And we'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes for this episode so that folks can check it out, because they really should check it out and be aware of the resources that are available and what might be responding to an event.
Yeah, because a big problem we have with DMORT is family members want their family member back as soon as possible, but it's a time-taking process. Sometimes it takes time, you know. And when I worked for the medical examiner's office, people would call us and want the cause of death all the time, but it would take 3 to 4 to 6 weeks sometimes to get toxicology reports back, and the family would get very impatient. But it's just because they didn't know how long the process took, and we had to explain to them, you know, this is the process, you know, this is out of our hands, and it just takes time, you know, and we can only apologize, but sometimes it does take time to identify the cause of death, and it just takes time and patience and patience with the family and educating them and using your compassionate side. So
definitely. Well, we'll make sure that we do our part with this show to help folks understand a little bit about what to expect if you get deployed. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual places. If you look up Sam Bradley, you will probably find me on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and certainly the disasterpodcast.com webpage.
And, of course, everybody can find me under the handle PodMedic at most social media sites and locations out there. And, of course, everything, including this podcast and all of the programs that we create, both at the ProMed Network at ProMedNetwork.com and, of course, over at MedicCast.com. That's going to wrap us up, I think, Sam. This is a great episode. I'm so glad you had lunch with Troy the other day.
Yeah, and he even paid for it. That was even better.
Well,
I'm so fascinated.
Go ahead, Troy.
Last time we had lunch was about 5 years ago. We'll have to try to do it a little more often.
Yeah, that would be good. But, you know, this was fascinating, and I can think of just so many more areas we could build this out to, because the DMORT is definitely a big part of a deployment, a big part of a disaster. So hopefully we can get him back again and talk about some more stuff.
We're the big part that's unexposed, because we're the ones that aren't talked about. So,
well, you know, that's unfortunately the way the news covers things. You know, it's always exciting when there's still, you know, live people being pulled out of some location in a disaster. Once it's just reduced to human remains being recovered, it's not as exciting for the news folks, and they stop covering it, unfortunately.
I was in Oklahoma last year when we had the tornadoes. I'm also a paramedic, so I was working for IMSA in Oklahoma. And, you know, in initial numbers from the tornado was well over 300, 400 dead. And it ended up being, I think, less than 50. Don't quote me on that. But, you know, you get all these initial numbers, and it's like, oh, my God, you got all these people. Then you actually get on the ground and get the assessment team in there and determine the numbers aren't as high, which was very fortunate that it wasn't.
Sam, why don't you wrap us up?
I will. And I just realized our electricity went off. Again, Troy, please come back with us again. I think there's a whole lot more areas we can cover on this subject. But I think everything we've been talking about has made it very clear that disaster medicine is not everyday medicine.